Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Over the past 3 years, our podcast has examined a wide variety of topics, but one theme that keeps cropping up is whether or not the United States is becoming less religious. We've had a few shows devoted specifically to this topic, but more often our conversations veer into speculation about what the rise in religious nuns, individuals without any proclaimed religious affiliation, says about the spiritual state of our nation. Not surprisingly, many pastors and pundits are quite concerned about this trend. Secularization theorists and a batch of new atheists take this observation to mean that the U.S. is finally heading the way of Europe, a place where religious faith, whether practiced in public or private, seems to have been extinguished for all intents and purposes. Most of our insight into the question of America's religiosity is based upon polling data that comes from a number of sources. If you've ever received a call in the early evening asking whether you'd like to participate in a brief survey about your religious beliefs, and you have chosen to answer those questions, you are part of those data that are giving social scientists and public intellectuals ammunition to make their claims. But how accurate are those surveys? And what are they really telling us about the life of faith of the American people? We will answer those questions head-on today with somebody who asked people about their lives for a living, Dr. Frank Newport. Dr. Newport holds a PhD in sociology from the University of Michigan, where he went after attending Baylor University, and he currently serves as Gallup's editor-in-chief. You may quickly recognize the Gallup organization as being one of the first private firms to break into the business of public opinion polling, and it also maintains a reputation as being one of the most accurate of the polling houses around. I should add that in addition to being an executive at Gallup, Frank Newport has also written several books, two of which we will be talking about today: Polling Matters, Why Leaders Must Listen to the Wisdom of the People, and, most recently, God is Alive and Well, The Future of Religion in America. Both books and additional information will be linked on our website and our Facebook fan page, so please check it out. Frank, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony. Good to be with you.
Okay, I have to get right to the heart of this matter here and ask you a question that I think is on everybody's mind. Does polling tell us whether or not the University of Michigan will be playing Baylor for the NCAA's National Championship in football this year? And if so, who are you cheering for? Because you've played, you've been at both universities.
Well, that's an excellent question. I do believe in polling. There was a ranking by coaches polling that's come out prior to the season starting, which had Michigan in the top 20, I think, and Baylor was nowhere to be found.
Uh-oh.
I believe in polling, so I would have to say, based on that evidence, at least the wisdom of the coaches before the season started, that Michigan probably has a better chance of being in that championship game than Baylor.
Okay.
And it's probably unlikely that either's going to be there.
Oh, well, you got to have faith. You got to have faith. Keep that faith up. I have to ask, though, if Baylor did play Michigan, since you attended both, Michigan for graduate school, Baylor as undergraduate, who would you cheer for?
You know, that's a good question. When I was at graduate school at the University of Michigan, I went to a Baylor-Michigan game. They're in the big house. We called it in Ann Arbor.
Yeah.
Over 100,000 people, and I don't remember. I think I was neutral and cheered for one in one quarter and the other in the other quarter. I have a strong allegiance to both schools. They're both great schools, and I'm proud to have gone to both of them. And actually, in recent years, Baylor in particular has really revved up its athletic program.
And it certainly has.
Football and women's basketball.
Yep.
Michigan, of course, has been a perennial national sports power for many years.
Well, that was a very diplomatic answer to
Thank
make sure
much.
You didn't alienate anybody. So I have been in that situation with UCLA and Baylor and Washington and Baylor a couple times. So, but we're not here to talk about football. I could talk about football all day, but we're here to talk about religion. And your book, God is Alive and Well, which swims against the stream of popular opinion today, given that you don't see a secular apocalypse hitting the nation anytime soon. We want to get to your findings and conclusions from that study, which is based upon extensive polling that you've conducted with Gallup. But before we get there, I want to spend some time discussing the nature of survey research, given that much of what we know about religion in the U.S. comes from this particular methodology. And I really do think it would be worthwhile for our listeners to learn a little bit more about how surveys operate, what their shortcomings might be, and how researchers such as yourself overcome those problems. And as a point of full disclosure here, I will note that I worked in the marketing research business many years ago and conducted and analyzed a goodly amount of polling data. And as such, I'm familiar with the process, yet as someone who has inhabited the world of social science research for the past 25 plus years, I have a bit of healthy skepticism about the utility of such surveys, and I'm sure that some of our listeners may share some of my doubts and questions, so I'm going to give you a chance to make the case for public opinion research, as you do in your other book, Polling Matters. So let's start out with a few basic questions surrounding survey research, and I will toss out some of my doubts to you along the way so you can field those. Sound good?
Sounds good.
Okay, first off, give us an idea of how a typical survey, let's say on religious belief and practice, is conducted in the United States by Gallup.
Well, not so sure there's any more a typical survey, but I'm glad you pointed out that surveys are our best source of information about religion in America because the Census Bureau, which measures so much else, doesn't measure religion. It's prohibited from doing so by law, so we really don't have that basic core of information we do on religion that we do on education and distribution of race and income and all the other kind of variables, correctly so, that the U.S. Census Bureau measures. So we have to rely on private organizations to do this kind of measurement, of which Gallup is one. I would say today the typical survey is still done orally by phone. There are a variety of other ways that we conduct surveys. The basic idea, at least traditionally, has been that we want everybody in America to have an equal or known probability of falling into the sample. So you need a sampling frame that you can randomly select numbers from. In the old days, organizations like Gallup used to randomly select dwelling units. They would select sampling units, primary sampling units across the country, and send live human beings out there to knock on doors and do interviews. But starting in the late 80s, the industry shifted over to using telephones because all phone area codes and exchanges are known, and the samples are taken from those. In more recent years, the industry, of course, has been highly cognizant of the fact that many Americans now don't have landlines but communicate by cell phones. But we sample randomly from cell phones as well. Gallup now, half of our interviews are conducted on cell phones, the other on landlines.
Hmm.
So in a shorthand, that's how most interviews, but not all, are done these days. There's been a resurgence of interest in address-based sampling, that is going back to mail sampling, where you do a random sample of all addresses in America and send out mail surveys. And, of course, there's always interest in trying to use the Internet or smartphones in one way or the other, but those methods have significant methodological sampling issues, I would say, still at this point, although everybody's looking into those.
What are some of those sampling issues with the smartphones or Internet surveys? I know a lot of our listeners might come across a website that says, take a survey on this, that, or the other thing, and you click on these things.
The issue is that there's no sampling frame.
No sampling frame.
Yeah, we don't have a list, a comprehensive list of all email addresses in the country, so we can't randomly sample email addresses and then send out an email to get people to answer. And there are still, believe it or not, at this point in time, you know, a healthy slice of Americans who don't actively access the Internet, older people and others like that. So that's an issue as well. Same thing with smartphones. Although a lot of us text and use smartphones, there's no way for us to randomly sample and send you out a text message. So you, for those kinds of surveys, we call them non-probability or convenience samples, where you have to just gather together even millions of people who answer those surveys and then somehow try to weight them, try to make them representative of the U.S. population. And although there's increased effort in that area, traditionally statisticians tell us there's no mathematical way of really ascertaining how accurately that can represent all Americans.
Mm-hmm. Talking about trying to represent all Americans, we see a lot of times on the news reporting that a survey has taken a sample of 1,200 people or 1,300 people. And that seems like a really small number for such a large country. And even if you did a state like California, you would think, well, you'd certainly want to have a lot more. What is the deal with small sample sizes relative to the population of, say, 1,200 or so?
Well, you know, the answer to that is that the sample size per se really doesn't matter that much. It's how the sample is obtained. That's the traditional answer. Remember, your doctor, when he tests your cholesterol, doesn't drain your body. He takes a small sample of that blood, and that seems to be representative. If a cook has a vat of soup in the kitchen, as Dr. George Gallup used to say, you can stir it up and take a sip and know how salty the whole vat is. So the idea that a small sample can represent a large population is certainly a well-documented mathematical phenomenon in the statistical literature. And it's really, again, not the size so much as it is how it was selected. As I mentioned a minute ago, you can have 1 million people who online answer a survey, but that can be unrepresentative if everybody who answers it happens to be living in California or be redheaded or be on sports sites, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So what the industry's done traditionally is tried to look for a balance between getting a big enough sample to be representative and to be able to break it into subgroup components and not having to break the bank mm-hmm. by doing huge samples. And the industry generally has settled into about 1,000 to 1,500 is a size that meets those requirements. If it's randomly selected, believe it or not, 1,000 to 1,500 people can accurately represent with the margin of error what would have been obtained had everybody been interviewed, and yet it's not hugely expensive. The dollar amounts actually double or triple if you double or triple the sample size, but your accuracy really doesn't increase that much. So you can go from 1,500 to 5,000 interviews, and that's a big cost jump because every interview has a marginal cost of production. Yet your reduction in error really isn't that much. Might go from, let's say, 3.5% to 1.5% margin of error. So you really don't get a bang for the buck by doing those huge samples, generally speaking. Now, here at Gallup, we have some research we'll talk about in a few minutes where we've interviewed, you know, 350,000 people in a given year for different reasons. So we do have some huge, large samples, which is great because it allows us to do a lot of breaking down into obscure small slivers of the population, but for a general representation of the population, 1 to 2,000 people seems to work.
Yes, the old central limit theorem, as I remember from my statistical classes. One of the things that I found very interesting is that there was a survey conducted by Trinity College or Trinity University several years ago, the American Religious Identification Survey, and I had a number of people asking me, wow, that survey must be really good because it had a sample size of 65,000. And when I saw that, my head kind of popped out and said, wow, 65,000, that must have cost them $1 billion or a lot of money. And so I oftentimes tell people that getting, as what you just said, you know, roughly about 1,200, 1,300 people, give or take a few hundred, is actually where you do get most of your bang for your buck.
Yeah, I think that for me with that survey, one of the reasons they have such a large sample is they ride the religion questions on another survey. I think it's being done for other purposes. Now, there is an advantage for religious denomination identification having the large samples, though, and that's because there's so many tiny denominations out there. In a sample of 1,000, we can certainly ask Protestant, Catholic, Jewish, Muslim, Mormon, or other religion, but we can't break down, you know, Northern Baptist from Southern Baptist and so forth, because they're just, those are two small slivers.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have the very, very large sample sizes, then it does allow you to do some more precise subgroup analysis, which they do in that survey. So it has its purposes.
Mm-hmm. Very much like medical research needs very large sample sizes to find small populations that have a certain rare cancer or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
To what extent are surveys truly random? We talked about the sampling frame, and as long as the sampling frame, it's you draw from it randomly, everything is great. But is that an easy process, or are there some difficulties associated with that?
Oh, there are huge difficulties. You should come to our annual meetings of the American Association for Public Opinion Research, APOR, which is our largest professional organization of survey researchers and pollsters from the government, from academia, and from private firms. We have conferences once a year in May, and most of our sessions, if you came to them, would be pretty amazing in terms of the depth in which they go into these methodological challenges, which are changing all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we here at Gallup have teams of methodologists. I'm in meetings all the time where we're looking at some of the nuances and changes of trying to represent the public. So there are many challenges out there trying to randomly sample the public and then generalize back to what we would have gotten if we had gotten everybody. Non-response rates is one. More people now won't take surveys or we can't get hold of them, so we're concerned, does that introduce a bias? A lot of weighting considerations, because when you do some of your interviews on cell phones and some of them on landlines, you've got to statistically put that back together, and that's an issue. And a variety of other factors which make this really a challenge to do a good job.
One of the things that I remember doing surveys back in the early 90s with the private firm that I was working for was this issue of exchange, telephone exchanges. Not all of them were filled up. And so oftentimes we excluded very lightly populated exchanges. And for those of you who don't know a telephone exchange, you have your area code, which might be 206, and then your exchange is those next three numbers, 785. And then after that, you have 10,000 possible numbers that could be combined for a telephone number. And oftentimes new telephone exchanges and a new subdivision or area that was growing would not be filled up. And so oftentimes we had clients that would say, well, you know, you're going to call into that area and you're going to consistently get numbers that aren't filled, and that's a waste of time for the researchers. Let's just focus on the filled ones. Do you guys deal with that issue at all?
Oh, yeah. That's a very important issue, very complex issues. In fact, I was in a meeting last week for 3 hours with a firm that does nothing but try to figure that out, a sampling providing firm. There are several professional firms out there that Gallup contracts with who do nothing but try to be cognizant of these area codes and exchanges and which ones are filled and which one are not to try to develop a sample. So it's very complex. A lot of these firms actually will do calling where they'll call into exchanges, and if nobody's answering it, they'll exclude that or leave it in. You're right, there's some technical considerations. If it has a very low percent of numbers in an exchange, you include it. All kinds of ramifications there. The good news is, as I mentioned, that we are able to work with sampling firms that do this for a living, full of PhDs, to try to figure all these things out. So they're on the case, and I think they end up doing a pretty good job.
One of the other things you just mentioned a moment ago was this issue of response rates, and that can have an impact upon the randomness of a survey. Even though you might be randomly sampling from the frame and everything is perfect textbook methodologically sound, people still will not respond. They'll get the call and they'll hang up or say, I don't want to participate. And that the people who don't participate are may be different than the people who do participate. And response rates are a very important concern for a number of polling houses. I remember back in the early 90s when we were doing surveys, we would be getting response rates in the neighborhood of 40%. Has that changed over time?
Oh, yeah. Partially, response rates depend on how you calculate them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, currently the official response rates reported by a lot of organizations like Gallup are in the 10 to 15% rate. So they're low, very low, but it depends on how. That doesn't mean that only 10% of everybody you contact actually interviews, the rest say no and hang up. It means a lot of the people you never get hold of.
Right.
But the big concern there is bias, as I mentioned earlier. We don't care about the fact that it's a low response rate in general, because after all, we're using a small number of people to represent millions. So if it's a random group of 10 or 15% who respond, it doesn't bother us. But it is. If the question is there bias? If all, for example, Democrats refused to do polls and Republicans all were happy to do polls, then we would have a bias. We do know that old people, generally speaking, older people, are more likely to conduct surveys with us than younger people we reach and so forth. So we engage in a lot of activities to try to mitigate response rate problems, including weighting the data to census parameters. That is, once we have a complete sample, we'll look at the census distribution of age, and if we have more 65 pluses and not enough 18 to 29s, we'll weight up statistically the representation of the younger people in the sample and so forth. So we address it that way. But it is something we have to be vigilant about. We don't want biases to enter into the samples, so as an industry, we're constantly monitoring that and trying to make sure they don't.
I know in our household, there's a gender difference. I love answering polls, since I used to work in that industry, but my wife does not, and ironically, she also used to work in that industry as well. But whenever the phone rings, I always run, oh, if it's a poll, let me take it. I'd love to take it, and I'll spend 25, 30 minutes talking with folks. But
well, it's a difference. Used to be that women were more likely to answer on landlines. When we introduced cell phones, we found men are more likely to answer a survey on a cell phone. So it's complicated. We have respondent selection procedures generally. So if we had called into your home and you answered, we might have said, no, we need to talk to your wife on a random basis and so forth and so on. But it's an issue. All of these are very, very important technical issues, which as an industry, we at Gallup and most other organizations are constantly trying to get right.
I have to ask about cell phones, because when I was working in the polling industry two decades ago, cell phones were a novelty. Only the richest folks had them, or tech people had them. And so it wasn't that big of a concern. But nowadays, most of my students actually don't have landlines. They have cell phones. And it's interesting, because with a cell phone, you're taking it everywhere you go. Sometimes you're sitting on a bus, or you're out there at a cafe on the street corner, and somebody calls you for one of these surveys. I think if I got a survey about my political beliefs or my religious beliefs, I'd be more hesitant to be answering on the cell phone than in the privacy of my own home with a landline. Have you noticed that effect at all?
It is an issue, because cell phones, the landlines are tethered to your house, obviously, and cell phones you can answer anywhere. We do a couple of things. One is we immediately ask if you're driving, and if so, we say we'll call you back. But on cell phones, we also very much will ask people if they would like to be interviewed later, and we'll call them back. And a lot of people are amenable to that. They'll say, as you say, I'm walking down the street right now, but if you call me back at 8 tonight, I'll be happy to do it. Hmm. So we make appointments and enter that into the computer and then call back and interview people there. You're right about CPOs, which isn't chief petty officers. For those in the Navy, that's cell phone only. There are a lot of them out there. More people have cell phones than landlines now. So that's one of the reasons that we've kind of pioneered in increasing the percentage of interviews on cell phones we conduct. And we're now up, as I said, to half on cell phones, and may even do a higher percent on cell phones as we move forward.
I know that there's been a concern about telemarketing, and this was something that I saw a couple decades ago, that telemarketing was becoming more prominent. And whereas people were happy to answer surveys in the past, people started to become suspicious that, oh, you're going to ask me questions, but yeah, I know after 5 minutes, you're going to try to sell me that timeshare in the Bahamas. Is there a way that you have in dealing with that? And has also the legislation that allows people to put themselves on no-call list, has that affected the way you conduct surveys?
The legislation's actually been a positive for our industry, because we are excluded. So the more people that are not called by telemarketers on the do-not-call list, the better we are, because it's more of a rarity to get a call like ours. So, you know, if you're getting 10 calls during dinner, you're not going to be are you going to be less likely, I should say, to answer the 11th call if it's from us. But if you get no calls from telemarketers, then our call is more of a novelty, and you might be more likely to take it. So that legislation has actually helped us. As an industry, we're constantly focusing on legislation, because we don't want Congress to get overzealous and try to exclude legitimate survey organizations, including the U.S. Census Bureau, which does telephone sampling, from actually doing those calls. But that's actually helped us, as I said. Telemarketing is a problem. We have an advantage. We just did a test and showed that it would Gallup shows up on your caller ID. And we say we're calling from Gallup, we get an increased response rate. We actually did a random sample survey a little earlier this year where half the calls we made, we used a firm name that we had used in the past in our companies, Selection Research Incorporated, more innocuous name, and half we said Gallup. And sure enough, when the dust settled, we found we had a 40% increased response rate calling from Gallup. So that's an advantage that we have.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask about this issue of telemarketing, and people are becoming more familiar with people calling into their homes. And this is a related issue to the non-response bias, but it's one that survey researchers call response bias. It's the way that they actually answer questions strategically in order to, I don't know, try to juice the survey results or try to figure out what the surveyors are trying to do. If somebody called me wanting to ask a few questions about my religious practice, and I didn't want to respond, but I also didn't want to be rude to the person on the other end because I know that, you know, they're just trying to make a living by being a surveyor for a company. The way that I would respond to the usual first question of, are you religious or what is your religious affiliation, would be the question, no, I'm not religious, because immediately that sends out a cue. If you're asking about my religion and I say yes, you're probably going to ask me 20 more questions about it and it's going to last 10 more minutes. I don't have time. So if I just say no, I feel like I'm doing my part and being courteous to you, but on the other hand, I'm getting you off the phone pretty quick. Is there a sense that some people are strategically answering these questions to be polite to the researcher, but then also to get them off the line?
Well, that's a complex question, and again, something that we look at. In our surveys about religion, usually religion questions are embedded later in the survey, so we don't just start right out asking about it.
Mm-hmm.
But there's always that question which arises. We're measuring a verbal behavior, after all, and we know from all our social psychological studies that presentation of self is a part of what we do as humans. So we are concerned about how people answer. And if they're trying to answer for a variety of reasons in a way that doesn't accurately reflect their self-reflection. You know, it's complicated. Usually when we ask people a question about an attitude or a past behavior, their kind of cognitive side has to kind of go searching in their brain and see if they can figure it out for themselves, because we don't self-assess a lot. So we're asking you to do a cognitive task here and self-assess. So it can be varied depending on what's going on in the environment. So we have to be sensitive to that. There's been, in the religion arena, there's been a lot of attention paid to church attendance over the years, not in the direction you mentioned, where you were saying I'm not religious, but in the other direction, where people over-report church attendance. And this researcher and that researcher have tried to look at it, and they, you know, several studies have documented that people to some degree probably over-report the frequency with which they attend religious services if we were able to follow them around with the video camera. But other research shows that that's okay, because self-reported church attendance is a pretty good measure of religiosity.
Mm-hmm.
So even if I kind of generalize, yeah, I go weekly, even though I may not go every week, it tells me that I'm a pretty religious person, so it's pretty accurate. But there are a lot of complexities involved in this whole process of verbal behavior, where we ask people in a telephone interview, you know, go into your own mental cognitive memory bank up there and pull out an attitude on this, that, and the other. It can be complicated.
You know, the reason I'm asking that, and I'm glad you mentioned the fact that there are people who respond in socially acceptable ways. And we know this in political science, that when people are asked if they vote, everybody says, oh, yes, of course we vote. And the, you know, voting rates skyrocket to 75%, but we know at most 50% in any given election vote, and possibly far fewer. So people want to give that socially acceptable answer, just like in religion. Do you attend religious service weeklies? And you're sitting in your brain saying, yeah, I know I should be. And then it comes out of your mouth, oh, yes, of course I do attend them weekly. And I'm just, you know, in many ways, I'm wondering how this has changed over the past decade or two decades. Have you noticed any shift in these kind of behaviors? Are people more willing to be honest in their answers? Are they more willing, or are they still giving socially acceptable answers?
Well, that's hard to document. You know, that's a good question, a good scholarly question. Academically, it's probably difficult to precisely measure that over time. I think, in my own opinion, and we'll probably talk about this a little later, people may be a little more free to be honest now than they used to be. We have an environment now which is more transparent. You know, people are somewhat more open than they may have been in the past, and people may be more likely to than the straight-laced days, say, of the 50s or 60s. For example, we now, at the back of all of our surveys, ask, are you lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender? And we thought initially, you know, that might be an issue with some respondents. We worked with an expert on the LGBT demographics from UCLA, and we tested various wordings, and it ends up being a fairly reliable measure, and our interviewers report no issues at all with asking that question.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to religion, I think, as we'll talk about in a few minutes, this kind of thing probably has something to do with the increase in the nuns.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much a change in the underlying religiosity of our respondents, but rather a change in how they report on their own religious identification. I think that probably has changed, particularly since the 50s or 60s, and accounts for one of the reasons we have a rise in nuns.
I want to come back to that in just a minute here, and it will provide a good transition for our discussion of what the American religious landscape looks like. But I have one more question that has always interested me, and I'm wondering if Gallup does studies on this, and that's the issue of interviewer interaction. Does the person who is asking the question have an effect on the responses that we get? For example, if the person on the other end of the phone sounds African-American to me, I might be less willing to express my disapproval of President Obama. I might want to give a more socially acceptable answer. Or if I hear, perhaps on a religious survey, an older woman with this delightful Southern accent, and I think, oh, she must be a Southern Baptist, and since I'm affiliated with Baylor, I don't want to let her down, so I'm going to give her more pleasing answers that I think she wants to hear. Of course, I go to church four times a week, you know. Is there any interviewer effect, and does Gallup try to adjust for that as well?
There can be, and that's certainly been an area that's been looked at. We did quite a bit of research relating to the election on that this year, as a matter of fact. Spent a lot of money, did a lot of experimentation on what you mentioned, that is, black versus white interviewers and an impact on political attitudes. Particularly when you have a black president of the United States running for office, you know, ask who you're going to vote for, there is a hypothesis that the perceived race of the interviewer could interact with how individuals respond. And we looked at it carefully. We actually did experiments. We created our interviewing force at Gallup, where we half the interviews were conducted by African-American interviews, and the other it was just, you know, 8%. And we looked at it this way and that way, and our final conclusion was, at least based on that research, there really wasn't a significant effect. Hmm. We couldn't document that the race of the interviewer made a big difference, a statistically significant difference, I should say, in whether people said they were going to be voting for Romney or for Obama or presidential approval and some other measures like that. So it's certainly possible that it could make a difference. But and some studies have shown that it does make a difference. Some academic studies, a professor at Stanford presented some research saying that maybe black interviewers were better able to obtain cooperation from black respondents to keep them on the line, even though it might not affect how they answer. So that's a possibility as well. Or a Hispanic, a Latino interviewer might be more successful at keeping a Hispanic or Latino respondent on the line as well. So there's some things along those lines that might be out there. But sometimes it's difficult to actually document statistically that they're going on.
I want to now turn to the issue that I called you about, which is the issue of religion and what's happening to religiosity here in the United States. And this turns to your most recent book, God is Alive and Well. And again, we will link to that on our website. What have you actually been finding in these surveys? And actually, let's go ahead and start with what you start the book out with. And that's this very big topic that people are talking about today, the issue of religious nuns. Is there really a dramatic increase in the number of people answering the question, what is your religious affiliation? And they say, none.
There is. And I always say when I make a speech about this, it's N-O-N-E-S nuns, not N-U-N-S.
Yep.
People say, oh, I thought the, you know, there are fewer women who are going into becoming nuns these days, but that's not the issue. Yeah, a lot of work in this arena. In fact, I'm going to be making a presentation, a speech at a conference in Washington next week, which is just going to be on that topic. But there's no question that when you look at any survey that has measured religious identification over time, it will show an increase in nuns. And again, let's make sure we understand, the listeners understand what we're talking about. A classic question, what's your religion? Usually it's something along these lines. What is your religion? Are you Protestant, Jewish, Catholic, Muslim, Mormon, Hindu, or some other religion, or no religion? That's the classic way that we ask it.
Mm-hmm.
And the trends are clear. In the 50s, some Gallup surveys that asked that question got 0% who said none. That is, 100% of the people said they had identification. Some of them, it was 98% had identification, 2% nuns. And one of the phenomenon that we've all measured in recent decades has been an increase in the percent who say none in the surveys. In our most recent surveys, we're up to about 18% who say none. Some other surveys have shown it up to 20%, about the same, but clearly that's a big increase because, again, in the good old days of the 50s and 60s, you might have almost everybody given identification, and now, as I just mentioned, you may be up to almost a fifth of Americans who don't. The real scholarly interest and the interest that fascinates us all is what does that tell us? Mm-hmm. And some people have leaped on that change and said, aha, that proves that America's secularizing, becoming less religious, and so forth. But a lot of other scholars have looked at it more carefully and try to say, wait a minute, what is this really telling us? And that's the subject of an intense amount of fascinating research, particularly in recent years, the phenomenon of what the rise in the nuns really tells us.
So let's go ahead and probe this a little bit more and find out who these nuns are. Is there a demographic skew to this? Are they younger people, older people, men, women, certain ethnicities? Who are the nuns?
Well, the nuns in general tend to have the same demographic characteristic to skew in the direction as people who are less religious on other measures. So there is a correlation there. And we know from all of our research, for example, that those people who are younger or are less religious on most indicators, and sure enough, younger Americans are more likely to be nuns than those who are, say, 65 or 75 plus. We know from all of our research that women are more likely to be religious than men, and sure enough, women are more likely to be nuns. There is a race and ethnic component.
Wait. You said women are more likely to become nuns?
Oh, I'm sorry if I misstated. Women are more likely to be religious than men. Therefore,
okay.
Women are less likely to be nuns.
Okay.
In fact, I just did a big study. That's true at all ages. 18-year-old women are more likely to have an identification than men, and 80-year-old women are more likely to have a religious identification than men.
Got it.
African Americans are less likely to be nuns. So they're more religious. And there's some geographic distribution which follows the typical patterns of religiosity. Those in the South more likely to have identity than those, say, in Washington State, which mm-hmm. is one of the least religious states, I should point out, in the country, along with Vermont, New Hampshire, and Oregon, and Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
So those are some of the characteristics of nuns.
Is there any demographic trends over time? One of the things that I've been thinking about recently has been this issue of delayed marriages and also delayed child rearing. We know that, you know, throughout history, young people have tended to always be less religious because, you know, they're bulletproof and they don't have to worry about the great transcendental things because they're worried about being 20-year-olds or so. And but when individuals get married and they start having kids and they go, well, you know, maybe I want to raise my kid with a strong moral upbringing, they start drifting back to church. But in recent years, in recent decades, I should say, we've seen a tendency toward delayed marriages. People are not getting married at age 18, 19, 20, like they may have many, many decades ago, but now they're delaying marriage till in their 30s, and child rearing follows from that. Are you seeing that in surveys?
Yes. I talk about that in my book. Those are two demographic phenomena which are real. In fact, we're just publishing some research tomorrow on our website, not about religion and marital status, but just about marital status in general. We went and probed. We asked these young people who aren't married, do you want to get married someday? Why aren't you married? We did a lot of fascinating research on that. But clearly the census tells us the marriage rate is going down. People are delaying getting married as opposed to where it used to be. And as you mentioned, fertility is a correlate of marriage to some degree, although quite a few babies are born these days out of wedlock. But nevertheless, the fertility rate is down in general. There are fewer babies being born. The research documents conclusively that Americans, let's say between 18 and 45, who are married or have children, are significantly more likely to be religious than the people of exactly the same age who aren't married and don't have children. I did a lot of research on that. It looks like children is probably the more important of the two. There may be a causal relationship there. You have a child, you become more religious. Marriage causality is a question. You know, some people argue if you are religious, you're more likely to get married, so it works the other way around, mm-hmm. not that you get married and become more religious. But there is a correlation, and in answer to your question, sure, that creates an issue, which we're still monitoring, because if people don't have children and don't get married, they may be less likely to be religious, and that could counter this trend, I think, towards at least an even keel in religion. Mm-hmm. The big trend the other way around, of course, is the aging of America with the huge baby boom getting older, and I think they're going to be more religious. We got that going on the upside of religion, but if marriage rates and fertility rates stay low, that could have an impact on religiosity at the younger end of our demographic spectrum.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask a bit more probing question about who these nuns are, because if we just ask the simple question, what is your religious affiliation, and people answer none, one of the conclusions you could automatically jump to is that, aha, they're atheists or they're agnostics. Is this the case, or have you done additional research that probes the deeper spiritual beliefs and attitudes of these so-called nuns?
Well, I would say two things based on my research. One is there is quite a bit of, obviously nuns are less religious than people that have an affiliation. So there is a correlation going on there. But there's a lot of research that's been conducted by people in a variety of academic settings that show that these nuns do have spirituality. Quite a few of them are looking for religion. Quite a few of them believe in God. They're not atheists. There are a lot of things going on with this group of nuns other than they're just being correlated with being absolute atheists. So I think that's an important point. I also think, and this is my real conclusion on a lot of this, that what we're seeing here is not so much a change in what's going on underneath it all in religion, but what I might call more truth in reporting than we had in the old days. So let's say in the 50s, a Gallup interviewer called you up, and you had been raised a Catholic, but you didn't go to Mass at all. You were more likely, I think, to say, I'm Catholic rather than none. Or if you've been raised an Episcopalian or a Baptist, and the Gallup interviewer called you up in the 50s, you said, I'm Baptist, kind of dog tag religion, I call it.
Because mm-hmm.
when you went in the Army, they ask you for your religion to put on the dog tag, because if you're injured or in combat, they know what kind of chaplain to call over. Nowadays, fast forward to today, somebody calls you up, same people, let's say, we could magically transport these people to our current time frame. You're Catholic, but never go to Mass. You feel freer, I think, to say, I'm none. I don't go to Mass, so I just say I'm not Catholic. I think there's a difference now in how people report it, and I think there's some research that supports that as well. So it's like the same people that would have given a religion in the past nowadays are freer to say they're none. That doesn't necessarily mean that there's been some fundamental change in the religious composition of the population as much as there's been a change in how people report their religion nowadays, and that's an important distinction.
Yeah, do you think there's also an effect that as word gets out to the general public that more and more people are nuns, that none can become a success, socially acceptable answer now?
That would be part of the truth in reporting.
Yeah.
I think that in the old days, there may have been somewhat more of a social norm, sociologically speaking, for people to have a religion, just accept it that you did, kind of like an ethnic origin.
Right.
People, in sociological terms, we sometimes differentiate between an ascribed and an achieved characteristic. An ascribed characteristic is like skin color or ethnicity. Gender, these are things that you're born with, and achieved is something that can be modified or changed during your lifetime, like your income or education. So I think in the old days, quote old, 50s, 60s, religion may have had more of the characteristics of being an ascribed variable. That is, sure, I'm Catholic because I was raised Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
A little more like even the Jewish population may be today. They never go to synagogue, but they still look at being Jewish as more like being Irish, your ethnic origin. Today, I think religion may be viewed more as a achieved characteristic, something that you pick and choose and decide whether you want to be a religious in this area or that, and therefore you feel freer to say, well, at the moment, I don't have one. And some of that's borne out by some recent research we're doing. The Protestants are most likely to be shifting to nuns now. Catholics, interestingly, tend to be holding more steady as a percent of the population, maybe because Catholics view their religion a little more on the ascribed side, raised Catholic, I'm always Catholic, whereas with 2,000 denominations on the Protestant side and a lot of non-denominational churches, it's a lot more fluid, and therefore people raised Protestant at some juncture in their life can feel freer to tell an interviewer, I'm a nun.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That we see Protestants slipping into that nun category in the fact that the United States has, for most of its history, been a largely Protestant nation, gets people thinking about whether or not we are still a Christian nation. And this gets to the issue of religious pluralism, religious diversity. And you have a chapter on that in your book, God is Alive and Well. And you start off that chapter with an interesting note that we tend to say happy holidays nowadays instead of Merry Christmas. What is happening in terms of religious pluralism and our Christian culture or our Protestant culture?
Well, it's very interesting. There has been no increase in the percent of Americans, basically no increase in the percent of Americans who are non-Christian religious.
Mm-hmm.
Jews actually have shrunken slightly, from 2% to a little under 2%. Muslims, Hindus, people in those areas, other undefined non-Christian religions haven't really increased significantly, despite, immigration coming in from Asian countries where those religions are more dominant. You know, maybe 5% of Americans identify with a non-Christian religion, and that's really not too much different than what it's been historically. So if you just look at people who give a religious identity, the country's overwhelmingly 90% or more Christian in its religious affiliation. Of course, as we've been talking about, we now have 18 to 20% who don't give a religion at all. So the percent who are Christians been dropping because most of that's come out of the Protestant group. Definitely, if you look at the graph, there's no question that the percent nuns go up, the percent Protestant has come down over the years. But still, we have in our, if you put together Protestants and other non-Catholic Christians, that's a little more than half of Americans. Catholics could be up to a quarter of Americans. So you're well into the 70% range of Americans are Christian of one sort or the other. You add 5% are non-Christian, and you add the 18% are none, and that's your 100%.
What about the issue of non-denominational Christians? And this is something that I have noticed here at the grassroots, that a lot of people don't affiliate with the traditional labels of Methodist or Baptist or Presbyterian anymore, but there's been a growth of non-denominational churches. In addition, many people are actually saying, I'm not Christian, I'm a Jesus follower. And there seems to have been a rebellion against formal religion, and that's associated with the term Christian or Protestant or Methodist, whatever it might be. Have you picked up some of that in the data?
Oh, yeah. I think that's part and parcel of this increase of nuns. We're losing a lot of the labels that we've used in the past. In fact, I have a section in the book on this, just the term Protestant. In our surveys, we'll say, are you Protestant, Catholic, so forth? And a lot of young people today say, well, I'm other. I'm not Protestant. I'm not Catholic. I'm not Jewish. I'm not Muslim, and so forth. So we then probe and say, all right, what's the other? And they say, oh, I'm Baptist. Or I'm Christian. You say, what? You just said you weren't Protestant, but they don't comprehend the word Protestant. That word's kind of gone out of favor now. So you have to be careful how you measure it. And you're absolutely right. If there is a phenomenon in the non-Catholic Christian field in America, it's the rise of non-denominational churches. They're the big churches, the growth churches in this country, generally speaking. And a lot of people, therefore, just call themselves, if they do call themselves anything Christian, or as you say, they could say, well, I'm a Bible church member, maybe a follower of Jesus, and so forth. So these labels are crumbling, which is part of the whole issue here. It's getting trickier to measure religious identification because we have these drop in the percent of Americans who stick with the old familiar labels that most people would have chosen in the 50s.
And that's one of the other big issues that you bring up in your book, God is Alive and Well. It's this issue of people switching and the fluidity of their affiliations, of the labels that we see. And you have some interesting observations based upon the data that you have been looking at, dealing with religious switching and mobility and which religions are growing and which ones are not. You actually have a little section there saying how not to grow a religion. Give us some idea of what you're finding there.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of ways that any organization can grow, and religious switching is a good way of looking at it. If you want to grow, even forgetting switching for the moment, one way that you grow is in what we call internal reproduction, that is having lots of babies. That's one thing, for example, in the Middle East situation, the Palestinians have a significantly higher fertility rate than the Israelis, the Jews in the Middle East, and Palestinians, if you interview them, will say, well, that may be the secret to our success, because in 20 years, we're just going to continue to multiply the Palestinians, and we're just going to be, on a numerical basis, overwhelming the Israelis, the Jewish Israelis, because they have a low fertility rate.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we have problems with fertility in Europe now. You know, we're not replacing the labor force in Europe because people are having fewer babies. So having babies is a real key to the growth in any entity, be it a country, a religion, or anything else. And the traditional mainline Protestant denominations and others, members just don't have enough babies. They're not reproducing enough in those areas. Mormons, of course, have a theological justification for having lots of babies, and that's one way they grow. Mm-hmm. You know, if every Mormon has eight children, and those eight children each have eight children, you don't have to be a mathematical genius to see that's a tremendous way to grow a religion in this country. Mm-hmm. Catholics used to have a fertility edge. As we all know, look at the Kennedy family and others, lots of Catholic children, but nowadays that's disappeared. Catholics are no more or less likely to have children than anybody else. So the Protestant mainline denominations have lost out on that dimension as well. They don't evangelize very well. Mormons, to give them credit again, have evangelism, that is conversion. Missionary work is a major part of what their religious denomination focuses on, and the Episcopalians, the Presbyterian, are actively out there knocking on doors trying to convert people to their religion. And also there's immigration. You know, another way that you grow any entity is to have people move in who have your faith. And the Catholics have certainly benefited from the influx of immigrants from Mexico, Central and South America, the majority of whom are Catholic in their profession, Spanish-speaking immigrants. So the Catholics have really benefited from that. And we've had no comparable immigration of, say, Episcopalians or Protestants like we had 200 years ago. They're not coming into this country, so they're losing out there. So on every front, a lot of these mainline denominations aren't doing much to help their own case in terms of growth.
Mm-hmm. Are there non-mainline denominations other than Mormons that seem to have an edge in terms of getting people to switch to their particular brand?
Well, you know, Baptists are down. I was raised as a Southern Baptist tradition. Baylor, of course, is a Southern Baptist school that I went to as an undergraduate. But mm-hmm. It's, you know, fewer people now identify as Southern Baptist than has been the case. So they're certainly not growing. As we talked about earlier, I think within the Protestant arena, the growth has come from Bible churches and non-denominational churches, in part not because immigrants are coming into the country who are already non-denominational, and not necessarily because they're having lots of babies, but because they're better at marketing. They're better at pulling people in because they have exciting new types of programs and more entertaining Sunday services and provisions for lots of different kind of people, you know, young singles, old singles ministries,
mm-hmm.
a variety of things like that. And they're clicking on a lot of cylinders there, dramatic preachers from the pulpit who can entertain well, dramatic, excellent music, so forth. All of these things seem to be pulling people into the non-denominational arena.
And comfortable chairs and coffee. That's very critical for me. I think you should do a poll on that.
I don't know about the comfortable chair. I know Joel Osteen, of course, is preaching in Houston in a basketball arena that used to have an NBA basketball team
playing. Yeah, but those chairs aren't comfortable. I've been to two churches that have had very comfortable arena chairs that have padding and cup holders.
You know, and it's interesting theologically because a lot of mainline, not a lot, but I think there are mainline theologians, pastors, and others, Protestant, traditional Presbyterian, Methodist, Episcopalian, who look askance at marketing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they think our job here is to present the doctrine of our theology and religion to people and not to revert to marketing or trying overtly to bring people in by having, you know, guitars and violins up at the front of the and screens with the words of the music at the front of the church. And that may be very noble sentiments, but they're shrinking.
Yeah.
So it's not, you know, their growth is not accelerating, it's shrinking. So I think there's a crisis in these mainline denominations they need to think about seriously.
Yeah, and including seating, as I mentioned, comfortable chairs.
Including
are
comfortable seating. I'm not sure how many Presbyterians, theologians, and ministers think about comfortable seating, but maybe they should be.
They should be, because as I get older and older, those wood pews just don't work with my back anymore. So we'll have to do that. One last interesting demographic trend that you talk about. You talk about a lot more of this stuff, and we'll point people back to your book, God is Alive and Well. But you talk about regional differences. And I have a couple former students, Paul Froese and Chris Bader, who were at Baylor. Chris is now at Chapman University, who did a survey looking at the different ways we conceive of God in different parts of the country. And you write about this as well. What do you see in terms of regional differences in the United States in your survey data?
Yeah. What I focus on for the most part is just straightforward religiosity. Mm-hmm. I did not delve into the way in which religion is presented, but there are huge differences. We know there are big political differences by state, red states, blue states, in this country. In fact, that's a lot of people say a big problem because most presidential candidates nowadays only focus on 10 states. Right. You know, they don't bother to campaign in California because they know that's going to vote to the Democratic candidate. Religion's very differentiated by state. Huge differences. The most religious state in the country is Mississippi, and the least is Vermont, and I contrast the difference between those two states, and it's just enormous. If you go to Vermont on a Sunday, you're just not going to see many people heading to the churches, religious worship centers, and if you go to Mississippi on a Sunday, you're probably be knocked over by all the people going to services. It's a normative thing. It's a cultural thing, I think. Some states have a cultural pattern which simply has as part of it the fact that you are religious and that you worship, and some states like Vermont don't. In addition to Vermont, New England's not religious at all. New Hampshire, Maine, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, these states are very unreligious. And up where University of Washington is, Washington and Oregon, as I mentioned earlier, are very unreligious states as well. So those two corners of the country are not very religious. The most religious states are in the Bible Belt in the South, and then you couple Utah on top of that with its majority Mormon population, and that gives you kind of a map of the country. Mm-hmm. And these are very, very strong, stable patterns, and not necessarily based on the type of people in the state or the type of religion that's predominant there. There's just something about Mississippi that promotes religion, and if you or I moved to Mississippi, I think we're more likely to become religious. And if you or I move to Vermont, we're more likely to become non-religious simply because of the culture in which we'll find ourselves.
And I think many people absorb or take signals from what people are doing around them. And if they see everybody getting in their Sunday best and heading out to the pews on a Sunday morning, they will join in on that march in that direction. But if everybody's lounging at home and getting up at noon, they will fit into that as well, I guess.
Yeah, I've done radio interviews with stations in New Hampshire, you know, one of the least, and they say, well, we're religious, we're just worshiping trees, you know, we're outside being spiritual on Sundays, just not conventional. That may be part of it, but yeah. If you're in New Hampshire, you're certainly not way below average in terms of conventional religiosity.
I want to leave off here with some general reflections that you have and wrap around to your other book called Polling Matters, which again, we'll link to on our website. Should clergy be panicking about the state of religiosity here in the United States, this increase in nuns? You may have already answered that, but this is a chance for you to give a more general reflection. And the other thing is, based upon your work with Gallup, how should clergy members, public opinion leaders, and the like be using the data that you provide to improve their own organizations and such?
Good questions, and you know, it parallels one of the themes of that other book, Polling Matters, which is how elected leaders should use polling. And a lot of elected leaders look askance at polling. They say, well, I'm smart, I don't need polling, or shouldn't even be using polling to tell me what to do, I'm the one who's smart. And I think a lot of religious leaders, as I alluded to a few minutes ago, have the same kind of perception, not so much that they're personally smart, but that they are, very theologically speaking, trying to be representative of a particular theological doctrine, and it's not their job to market or be aware of what these people are thinking. They just need to present what they say is right. After all, if Jesus had done marketing research, he certainly wouldn't have pushed his religion in the Jewish and other environment in which he was located. Mm-hmm. So you hear a lot of those kind of sentiments. I happen to think that religious leaders should pay attention to what the data tell us, and they should be willing to modify what they do. It's attention. You know, as I mentioned, a lot of religious leaders look askance negatively at the non-denominational churches and say they're just focused on marketing, not really religious. That's an interesting tension, interesting dialogue, interesting argument that's going on. But I think if a lot of religious leaders aren't paying attention to what the data tell them, they're going to die. You know, they'll be sticking to their principles and have three old people in the pews, and that's all on Sunday. So I think religious leaders should pay attention to what the data tell us. We are getting more baby boomers. What can they do to really address the needs of this huge group of people that are going into their senior years? How do they address the needs of men more, since men are less religious? There's a whole chapter in my book on how religions positively correlate with health and well-being. Maybe churches should focus on that more, and so on and so forth. So I would argue that anybody listening that's a religious leader should move a little more in the marketing side of things in order to survive.
Well, that is some fairly good advice. And for our listeners who are interested in this topic, you have several interesting books about this, and there's always something interesting happening at Gallup.com. So we will point folks in that direction. And so, Frank, I want to thank you for being the guest on Research on Religion today.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure being with you, and I enjoy talking with you.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.